everybody, and welcome to episode 9 of the World Hoppers podcast. I am Cheyenne, and I am here with my co-host, Alana, as well as our special guest, who I've mentioned many times here on the show before, Drew McCaffrey from the Inking Out Loud podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's an honor, really. Today we will be discussing Elantris, no pronunciation debates, because I know that happens with this book in particular.
Oh, yeah.
You make it so hard, though. I won't say anything.
Yeah, I've trained myself in the Ionic pronunciations, and so it's really funny because I've told the story a couple of times. There's an Isidai in the Wheel of Time called Serene, spelled exactly the same as Serene from Elantris. And so when I was rereading Wheel of Time earlier this year, like, my first thought was Serene, and I was like, wait, no, this is Wheel of Time, Serene.
Yeah, I definitely had that same problem when I first read Elantris.
Yeah, I didn't know that there were any different pronunciations, so I just went into it pronouncing it as I would, and then found out, like, 2 years later that I was doing it entirely wrong.
I mean, it doesn't matter, according to Brandon.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we will be avoiding spoilers for all of the Cosmere. Yeah, I mean, there isn't too much to avoid with Elantris. It's not, like, talking Rhythm of War without spoilers. The first episode of Oathbringer, which we were, like, recording really ahead of time, it was hard enough.
Oh, yeah.
And for those of you listening way in the future, the sequels haven't been published yet, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, I don't know when that'll happen, but...
Hopefully someday. So, like, normally we don't do this way, but I really wanted to talk about style with this book in particular, and also conversations that have come up before in our Discord, the fandom at large, and, I mean, this is partly why I wanted Drew on this episode, because having the perspective of a more experienced writer than me, and, well, especially talking about style, which is one of Inking Out Loud's strengths, is something I really wanted to bring to this conversation.
Sure, yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good book to talk about it, too, because it is the first published book from Brandon, and while I think overall his writing style hasn't changed a whole lot, he still more or less has the same strengths and weaknesses. He has improved a lot. The flow of his stories, especially the pacing of his stories, is dramatically different now in 2021 than it was in 2006, you know?
Yeah, the avalanche, I mean.
Yeah. I can't go into too many details as of now, but I just did the Lost Metal beta read, and it is very interesting reading that book and then, you know, sitting down to think about Elantris to prepare for this episode and comparing just how much Brandon has grown as a writer, how smoothly he weaves together different points of view in his more recent books like The Lost Metal or Rhythm of War or Cytonic or whatever. He really struggled in Elantris to make it even in pacing from character to character. And I think that's why a lot of people struggle with this book so much. I don't think it's necessarily a slow book the way a lot of people do, but it is not an even book, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, just like the fact that it's so structured in its point of view, like it goes Raoden, Serene, Prathin, and it just always goes that way until the avalanche, which is why the avalanche is so marked. It's insane. I mean, you compare it to Rhythm of War, where some people say there wasn't an avalanche, even though I disagree with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's much, much, like, clearer when the avalanche starts. Like, the second you start getting quick POV changes, like, this is it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sticking with that give-and-take structure of moving from each character and doing that rotation very strictly in Elantris, I do think, like, hampers the story a little bit, and as Brandon has gotten more comfortable in his writing and more confident in his writing, you can see that he doesn't box himself in that way anymore. He's much more cognizant of chapter arrangement and thematic pacing instead of just, all right, this is how I'm going to write the book. You know, even in Rhythm of War, he talked about, I think it was on one of his live streams, where based on beta read feedback, he changed the order of some chapters because in the beta read, he was like, you know, some people got bogged down in the story because I was arranging these chapters in this way. And I realized I didn't necessarily have to change the content, but if I just reordered the chapters a little bit and made the story flow much more smoothly. And I kind of wish he had done that in Elantris at a couple of points.
Yeah, there are definitely some points where I think it would have helped the pacing to have just stuck with one character a bit longer.
Yeah.
I'm reading like a chapter from one character. I'm like, this didn't really need to be here. Like, this is just here to fill in so we can get on to the next chapter with the next character. And so now seeing that he is more confident in like being like, no, the plot needs this, the characters need this, and being able to arrange it in a less structured manner is really nice to see.
Yeah, like,
yeah, definitely.
Partly why I'm so interested to see how the sequels turn out, because it's been so long and it's the same series. And like, okay, like where are you going to put them in the reading order? Because going from Elantris to like the sequels written I don't know how many years later, it's probably going to be a bit jarring, but I don't know how much sense it'll make, like, timeline-wise and Cosmere connections-wise and all that.
They're apparently supposed to be pretty important, because he's talked about how he needs to write them before he gets to the second half of Stormlight, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be interesting to see. Got no idea how that's going to turn out.
Yeah. But I'm also curious, he's been doing up to this point with each of the different worlds in the Cosmere and each of the different series and even the standalone books, there's usually a different kind of literary conceit that he's highlighting. And, you know, in Stormlight, he's doing this thing with the flashbacks. And in Warbreaker, he did a lot of things with parallels and duality. And here in Elantris, he did that thing with the hard rotating points of view. And it makes me wonder if he's going to try to stick with that theme where it's like three points of view, give and take, rotation. But if he does do that, I'm really curious to see how much, you know, his improvements in writing over the last 15 years or 20 years, as it will probably be before we get Elantris 2.
Oh, gosh,
if that will allow him to more smoothly pace the book while still retaining this structure.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's a structure that a lot of YA authors use, if I'm not mistaken, like going back and forth between one or between like two points of view. It's been ages since I read YA, but I've heard about that a lot. I think, well, a friend of mine really likes Rainbow Rowell's books, and like she does that with Eleanor and Park, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a while since I've read that.
Yeah, I haven't.
That sounds about right.
My friend really likes them.
Yeah, as someone that reads YA a bit more often, I do see this happen like a bit more often than I'd say I'd see in like YA, not YA, like adult fantasy and stuff. But it's usually also not as like a hard rotation. Like there are times where it just continues into the next character. And so I think that's why it is interesting to see, because this is kind of odd or like unusual, even in like YA.
Yeah. Yeah. There usually is, you know, kind of exceptions that prove the rule, so to speak, where even if an author has an idea and is like, all right, I'm going to do this, there are always going to be exigencies that arise during the writing process where it's like, okay, I have to break the rule to make the book work. And Brandon stuck with that hard in Elantris.
Until the Avalanche.
Yeah, until the Avalanche.
Yeah, another thing I really noticed a lot on this reread was Brandon's work with character voice, which is something like I've been focusing a lot lately because of the extended essay, and well, that's been Stormlight and Wheel of Time, and Jordan was a master at that.
Yeah.
But I thought it really interesting just like how I think I'd underestimated the use of character voice in Elantris, but he actually does it like really well for, well, his first published book. I mean, just the way their thoughts are structured reflect their characters really well. I mean, Raoden thinks like this prince was used to caring for his subjects and he's like really compassionate. Then he sentence structure like reflects that. Like also, well, his education. Serene is far more academic, like precise with her sentences. And like, well, it reflects her training in like politics and understanding like the deeper meanings of things and like the political clues. And Wraithens are precise in a very different way, representing like militaristic culture of his religion he's grown up in. And I thought that was really, really interesting, because I wouldn't have thought that a character voice would be one of those things I'd noticed so much in Elantris, comparing to like things like Stormlight much later. Also probably because like character voice is one of those things that is like really hard for me as a new writer, because they all sound like me. And so I thought it was really interesting that it was done so well in his first published book.
Yeah, I think one of the overlooked aspects of Brandon's writing is his strength with character, voice, and just attitudes shaping the stories. it's easy to read his books as largely plot-driven, because they are. I mean, especially in the Cosmere, where there is a larger plot informing everything that happens in these books. You know, like when we're talking about a universe that has gods, you know, there are invisible forces moving the people around. But that's not to say that the characters don't have agency or personality. And, you know, reading Elantris and reading some of his earlier unpublished things like The White Sand prose draft or Aether of Night, the characters are the strongest parts of it for me. And I think Elantris in particular is probably the most character-driven story he's written in the Cosmere, at least at the novel length. And I think this also plays into why so many people think this book is boring or think it's slow or badly paced or whatever. It's because they're looking for the plot-driven external momentum, and really what's driving the momentum of this book are the internal choices and changes the characters are undergoing. And when you look at it from that lens, it's actually a really fast book. Like, the last time I reread this, I was shocked at how early it was that Hraethen started struggling with his faith and started realizing he's being undermined. And, you know, we're like 5 Hraethen chapters in, and he's breaking down, and it's like, oh my gosh, I thought this didn't happen until, you know, the beginning of the Sanderlanch, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's really, really cool to see another kind of change in the way Brannon writes these books as he's gotten more leeway to make the Cosmere level more important. Whereas in this book, there's almost no Cosmere, you know, as Cheyenne talked about at the top. And so it's all about the characters.
Yeah, I think both of those really also work together to be kind of jarring in the reading order that we're going in, where we just ended with Mistborn Era 1, mm-hmm. which is very plot heavy, very Cosmere heavy, and not so character development heavy, I'd say. And then you immediately go into Elantris, which is like slower plot wise, a lot more character based, and like almost no Cosmere stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting just to see the development, where you immediately go from like Hero of Ages, where like it's just stuff is going down, and then you get to like, yeah, we're gonna hang out and like go to some parties and like do some fencing and like maybe something will happen. And it's just, it's a very interesting way to see the different sides of Brannon's writing, because I'm not saying one is better than the other. Elantris was my first Cosmere read, and I still love it. I think it's interesting to be able to examine like how he's changed as a writer.
For sure. And I think in the order you guys are going in, which, unless I'm mistaken, is my order.
It's your order.
Yep.
I put it there partially because I think Mistborn has that excitement factor and it's easier to get into it. But also because Elantris gives you kind of a breather. It's mm-hmm, like you can sit back and like, all right, all yeah. that stuff just went down. Now I'm going to read a book with lower stakes and a little more of an intimate character arc, and relax my shoulders a little bit before we ramp back up as the Cosmere progresses.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just need to look at C, which is the next one, because I still don't know it. Next one is Warbreaker. Mm. And then, well, after like White Sand and like some short stories, Era 2, which also has a lot of action.
Yeah. Oh, I'll definitely be tuning in to hear what you guys have to say about Warbreaker. And I have that right after Elantris for a reason too, because I think Warbreaker is similar to Elantris in some of the ways that Brannon uses character to move the story.
Yeah, Warbreaker was my first Sanderson book. It has a special place in my heart, even though I know some people don't like it as much.
Oh, I love that book. That book. I love that book.
I feel like you're calling me out, Jay. I will admit, Warbreaker is probably my least favorite Cosmere book so far, but...
Oh, really?
I did enjoy the character building that they did there. It just, I had some issues with different things. But yeah, definitely check back in for that episode, because I will probably talk a lot about that.
January, maybe? Oof. I don't know.
Excellent.
The other thing I wanted to talk about, this is a topic I love and I've done a lot of work on, is foreshadowing. Specifically the foreshadowing for Dakor. I found it really, really interesting this time around. Last summer, because I wanted to, I wrote this essay on Wheel of Time, Stormlights, there's some Mistborn. And then because of that, I was on the Dusty Wheel episode for Foreshadowing and Eye of the World.
Nice.
So I love the topic, and so I'm always bringing it up. It's also easier when I've managed to do a reread before an episode, because I can't always do that. And so I just have a couple of quotes here. They say, though many in the East dismissed Seons as Aeonic myths, Hraethen had, by this time, been taught that they were things in the world that were not understood by normal people. the memories of his early years in that core still caused him to shiver. And it's just such a throwaway line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It keeps coming up. Now, Raythan shivered at the thought of the monks trained inside of the Dakor Monastery gaining access to defenseless Aerlon. He glanced down at his arm, the place where beneath his plate armor he bore marks of his time there.
Yeah.
Wow, like, I mean, even the whole thing with, like, the twisted bones, like, not only the fear that Dakor produces in Raythan, but also, like, the twisted bones, I mean, it's there since the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, it plays in without explaining it. It at least lays the groundwork for Raythan's ultimate doubt and turning away from, you know, his religion and ultimately betraying them at the end. It's really, really nicely woven in. And I agree, it's a great example of foreshadowing because Brandit starts it with these little throwaway lines, and then each time it gets mentioned again, there's a little more of this sense of horror and unease attached to it. Mm-hmm. And you get some of these ideas of, like, not full flashbacks, but kind of mini images of him during his training where he's, like, lying on the floor on his back with the Dakor monks over him, and you're like, whoa, what's going on there? You know, and then ultimately gets one of the best reveals Brandon's ever done.
Yeah.
A thing I found really interesting is how in the, like, few scenes where they show Raythan doing, like, anything, like, physical, like, exercise at all, like, they remark on just how fast he is. He's always, like, okay, good training, militaristic culture, whatever. No, that's a tiny bit of, like, the remnants of that core of the time he was there. And so good.
Yeah. You know, as a growing writer, there's so much to learn from reading Brandon Sanderson, especially because you get to see how he grows. Like, it's really clear with him. You get to see how he changes his approach to things like foreshadowing and point of view after working on the Wheel of Time.
Wheel of Time, yes.
You know, because he did his, like, mega reread, his close reading of the Wheel of Time before starting work on The Gathering Storm. It's like comparing some of the things in Elantris to some of the things in The Way of Kings, or especially Words of Radiance and Oathbringer. Like, it's not that it's bad, but he goes about it in a different way. And I think it's a really valuable example for growing writers.
Yeah. So I've only read the, like, 10th anniversary edition, like the, like, revised edition.
Uh-huh.
So I read that back in, like, 2019, and then I got that edition whenever I bought it. And so I'd never heard of an author really going back and revising their work years after it comes out.
Yeah, Tolkien.
And so getting, like, yeah, well, true. I am a huge Hobbit nerd and all that, but,
yeah,
like, other, like, more modern authors, really. And
sure.
So getting, like, that bit at the end where he goes through and talks about all, like, the changes that he made, and, like, here's a chapter of something that I wanted to do, and then completely scrapped. And, like, I thought that was really interesting as someone who isn't really a writer or that interested in that side of things, just getting, like, a view into kind of his mindset whenever it comes to the changes that he needed to make and, like, how to make things flow properly, where he was like, hey, I really like this character, but, like, didn't work, so we just completely scrapped it and changed things around. I thought that was very interesting to get an idea of. I don't know how much has actually changed in the book itself, because I've only read this one, but it was just nice to have that kind of end chapter where he went through and was like, yeah, I made quite a few changes here now that I've grown as an author.
Yeah, definitely. Have either of you read the annotations for Elantris on his website?
No, I've read the ones for Mistborn. I haven't gotten to Elantris yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Yeah, I honestly read them years and years ago. I don't really remember them much. I just remembered about them when you were bringing up, you know, the stuff at the back of the 10th anniversary edition where he talks through the decisions to remove, like, the Mad Prince storyline. And also, you know, adding in a new epilogue with Hoid, where it's like, all right,
yes,
when he first published this book, he had the idea of the Cosmere's head, but it was still pretty nebulous. There were, like, he hadn't solidified the idea of a perpendicularity. Like, he had the shard pool in here, but he wasn't totally sure what it was gonna be.
And, like, you see that, like, in Aether, because Aether is shortly after, if I'm not mistaken, and Aether has some very weird things going on Cosmere-wise.
Yes, it does. But yeah, so, like, he got the opportunity to go back and be like, all right, I'm gonna solidify what's going on with this shard pool by writing a new epilogue. I'm gonna add content to this book. I wish I had that kind of opportunity as a writer to be like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to release a new version of this book.
Couple words of radiance.
Yeah, well, that's its own thing. But it is cool how transparent Brandon is in the 10th anniversary mm-hmm. edition of this, talking through the changes. You know, and obviously there are little continuity changes and grammar fixes and things like that. But the biggest changes he talks about are, you know, writing process things. Yeah, it was. I was going to ask you, Alana, whether or not you were a writer yourself. So that's good to know. Oh,
no, I am an engineering student, so like I am completely on the STEM side of things.
Gotcha. Yeah, but that also we get very interesting conversations about science when we talk about Stormlight.
Ooh, yeah, me and Alf get into like sciencey things. So it's nice, I guess, for Shay to have like another writer on here to chat with, because mm-hmm. I don't know anything of that side. I respect what you guys do, but I do not understand it.
Yeah. I had my opportunity to go into STEM. I was very nearly a chemistry major, but
nice.
I decided college level math was not for me.
Yeah.
I feel that even as a STEM major. Oof.
Analytic geometry. Oof. Hard pass.
Yeah, like I love science on like the theoretical level. There is a reason my science option for the IB is Nature of Science, which is very highly theoretical. Hardly any math. And then
right.
like I was like working on like my internal about funding theoretical science and all that, and I was reading these papers and there were so many formulas that I did not understand any of it.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, not at all a writer, but like seriously respect writers for what they do. I do not have the brain for that.
Sure. I know that was definitely a thing that my AP Chem teacher pushed me hard to like go to secondary, you know, post-secondary school for science, because he's like, you can write. No scientists can write. Like,
yeah. Oh my god, I've heard that from literally every one of my lecturers. They're like, oh my gosh, have you been writing essays? And I'm like, yeah, I have essay writing classes. And then they're like, oh, thank god.
Like, yeah,
the amount of technical reports you have to write, no matter what you go into in STEM, like... So I can get the facts across and everything, but like world building and stuff, I'm like, whoo, that's over my head.
Yeah, my grandmother is an English teacher. She talks so much about how so many people just don't know how to like write and get their ideas across properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. That's one thing that like I've been doing engineering classes since like my freshman year of high school, and my Yeah, I had a really great high school that did that. So I did all 4 years there, and then I'm doing that in college as well. So my teacher, freshman year, he's like, if you don't know how to write a technical report, you will not be an engineer. You have failed already. And I'm like, it's freshman year, man. Like, I just got here. So, like, he's had us writing, like, 5 technical reports every year, like, long things. And then I get to, like, my first class in college, and they're like, so here's what a technical report is. And I'm like, what? You're just learning this? Like... I had people just like writing like 3 sentences on a page and being like, that's it. And I'm like, that's not it, buddy. That no. we got to fix this.
That is,
yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, but it's funny, honestly, like looking at writing from from like a scientist perspective, from that more technical perspective, in a lot of ways, that is how Brandon approaches writing. And he has a background in science. If I remember right, like his parents wanted him to be a dentist or something like that.
A doctor. His major was biochem before he went to Korea and then switched to English.
Yeah. And it's clear that he has a very logical, structured approach to not just building his stories, but building his worlds. And I think it's a little bit of a double-edged sword being aware of that, because the more of his stuff you read, the more clearly you see the same things popping up over and over again. Like we, on Inking Out Loud, we just had Matthew Stover on for our Lies of Lockazora episode.
Oh my god, that is amazing.
Oh, it was one of the best days of my life. It was so much fun.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that guy may be my favorite living writer, but he talked a lot about reading Scott Lynch and how as a professional writer, a guy who's been writing for 40 years, he's like, I can see the gears that make, that turn and make the story move. But that's not necessarily a bad thing in the case of Scott Lynch, because he's like, they're, the way the gears work, the way they fit together and the way they turn is beautiful. And I think that's, as Brandon grows as a writer, it's really cool to see the way those gears fit together and become more elegant.
Yeah, I've noticed that absolutely. So much just working on my extended essay. Like, just today we had the first kite runner exam, and literally my first point in the discussion yesterday was emplacement. That is the first thing I noticed. I was like, yes, here it is. It's exactly what I've been researching all these months.
But as far as the character stuff, because I guess we got a little off track.
I mean, we always do.
It's fine. It happens with us on Aching Out Loud all the time, too. But I want to talk about Raythan, because he's, like, one of my favorite characters Brandon's ever written.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Like, it's just such a compelling character arc. I am a religious person, and I definitely went through a time in my life where I really struggled with my religion, and it was not so long after I read Elantris the first time that that happened, and it was like kind of when I was sorting things out in my head and coming to some conclusions and solidifying my faith that I went back and reread Elantris for the first time, and reading Raythan just crushed me. It is just such a powerful arc.
Oh yeah, no, I'm also a religious person, and I was literally reading Elantris in like the middle of my crisis of faith.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like, I'm feeling really called out right now. Like, okay, Brandon, like, take a step back. So like reading this now after I've worked through a lot of those issues and stuff was definitely interesting, because I was like, okay, I can see the little bits and pieces where I was like, yeah, at that moment, that's how I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And can really connect to that character, I guess.
Yeah, and it's really like interesting, because like Brandon is really religious himself, and he just writes religion so well. I mean, not only here, but we see it in Mistborn, like with Sazed's arc, like his exploration of different sides of religion and different perspectives, because it gives the world a lot of color. And I mean, Raythan was my least favorite the first time I read a book. I really connected with Raoden the first time.
Okay.
But just rereading it, he's just written so well. Like, voice-wise, Raythan was probably the one that most impressed me. Just, there's so much there, and his arc is really, really powerful. Just, Brandon's characters have a lot. And, like, people talk about, like, not liking, like, White Sands so much and all that, and, like, the people who've read Aether, and I love those.
Yeah, honestly, like, most of my favorite characters in the Cosmere are from Elantris, White Sand, and Aether of Night. Like, I think, in a way, Brandon having the opportunity to write the Cosmere meta story and get really, really epic with, you know, his career, in a way hampered his characters, because he spends more time on the bigger world-building and plot, and some of these earlier books are a little more contemplative and intimate with the characters, and you get to know them better. Like, Raythan and Dinah in Aether of Night are phenomenal.
Oh my god, like, yes. Like,
and Chris in White Sand, I'm so excited for the White Sand Omnibus to come out, because that's going to have more of a focus on Chris, and that they're going to write a sequel. Yeah, at this point, it sounds like it's kind of up in the air whether it'll be a prose novel or if they're going to do another graphic novel, but either way, it's going to be about Chris, and I'm like, she's my favorite character Brandon's ever written. And then we have Raythan in Elantris, where I'm like, this guy is so good, such a compelling arc. And that's not even to say that Raoden and Sairini aren't, they are really good characters, they are really compelling. I just happen to identify more with Raythan than either of them. But the way Brandon, like, I guess I'm repeating myself, the way he structured this book and the way the book moves is so internal with them. And I have this kind of my theory of importance.
Yes.
For what drives this book. And that's their kind of three sides of this triangle. And each one of the characters is a side. And their character arcs revolve around their relationship with being an important person. And with Raythan, he's losing his importance. He's being undermined. He's losing his faith. He's losing the ability to trust in the hierarchy that he's lived his whole life and identified with. And then with Raoden, it's all about accepting his importance. At first, he was denying it, that he didn't want to be the right kind of prince, so to speak. Like, he would rather spend his time, you know, caring for the little people and shirking his princely duties. And then he gets put in a situation where he has to assume responsibility and lead. And with Sairini, it's the aspiration to importance, where her whole life she has felt like an underdog and felt like she's being denied the respect and prestige and importance that she deserves. And it's all about her being proactive and grasping that importance. And I love that. I love how they have a unifying theme, but each have very different relationships with it.
Yeah, it's been ages since I listened to your Elaine Chen's episode, but I really saw that on this read-through, and, like, especially, like, with their different, like, insecurities.
Yeah.
Drew has a really good point, because, like, I listened to that, and I was like, okay, yeah, at this time, just reading it, I was like, this is so much stronger than I had assumed when I listened to that so many months after reading Elaine Chen's.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was something that kind of was like a thunderbolt out of, you know, a cloud, the sky, where when I was rereading the book for that Inking Out Loud episode and just kind of taking notes, I realized that I had been talking about importance in so many of their character notes. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the theme. This is it. Like, how have I never seen this before? But it took a really close reading before I figured it out. Like, the line that I put it all together was in chapter 24. And it was a Hraithen point of view. And he's reading, you know, this journal. And the journal says, I have found purpose. Before I lived, but I didn't know why. I have direction now. It gives glory to all that I do. I serve in Lord Jadith's empire, and my service is linked directly to him. I am important. And I highlighted, I am important. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the motivation of all three characters. Like, Sairini's an outsider, insecure but competent and thirsty to prove she's important. Raoden is important by default as prince, but doesn't see himself that way. Despite denying his importance, he still has to assume being a natural leader. And then Hraithen does see himself as important, but finds his importance is increasingly undercut.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, I just opened my ebook. I highlighted that same passage. Yeah, and I really like connected that like to identity, not only like character identity and all of that, but like capital I identity. Which I don't want to get too much into, but I think that like importance is a really like integral like part of that of identity, like because I mean sure there are lots of things that make up identity regardless of if it's Cosmere identity or just normal
sure.
identity, but importance is a really like important part of the way we like we perceive ourselves. And especially people in the roles that, like, Sairini, Raiden, and Hraithen have. I mean, a prince, a princess, and a Gjorn, who is, like, second only to, like, the leaders of the monasteries and the emperor in power in the, in Fjordal.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, of course it's going to be a really big part of their identity, like, their, like, roles in society. And the fact that their insecurities are, like, so tied to it. Sairini is because even though she's a princess, people didn't respect her back home.
Mm-hmm.
And so she really wants that respect. And, like, she wants to fit in. Like, she doesn't want to be feared. And she comments on that. I think it's in one of the fencing scenes. She's like, well, I guess that I'd always stand out here now. Like, that I can't fit in. Except, like, in this little group. But I'll take at least that respect over, like, the comments behind my back that I hadn't TO'd. Well, rather than, like, in his position of leadership. Well,
yeah, like, I know a lot of people, maybe not a lot of people, but I see this criticism pop up fairly often where so many of the main characters in the Cosmere are royalty or nobility. And I think that's a valid complaint in some situations, but in this book, I don't think so because of this theme of importance. It would be impossible to make these character arcs work with people who weren't at this level of a stratified society.
Yeah, no, I totally agree on that. Because I have complained about that, like, later on in the Cosmere, in things like Stormlight and stuff,
yeah.
where you're really getting just nobility's perspective on things, but it absolutely works in Elantris. And kind of connected to what Shay was saying about, like, identity, I don't know if I've, like, put this together in my head the correct way, but just because, like, all of their identities of, like, prince, princess, like, religious figure are all dependent on what other people think of them. Like, their power comes from the people
yeah.
that they not represent exactly, but, like, the people around them that give them power. And so they have to have this importance of identity and importance of being important in order to, like, properly do their jobs and retain that importance to the people, sort of thing.
You know, that's actually a really interesting point that I hadn't considered before, how so much of their character arcs is internalized relationship with importance, but that importance is, like, externally constructed.
Yeah. That's a much better way of saying what I just stumbled through. But yeah, just because, like, you see, like, Raiden is, like, forced into importance almost in Elantris, where he's like, I don't want them calling me Lord, I don't want them, like, giving me bodyguards, and they're like, you are an important person, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And whereas Serena is like, I am important, you need to respect me as an important person, and trying to work and gain that respect from the people around her.
But she doesn't reach that apotheosis of character until the people around her respect her and grant her that importance.
Yeah.
And in Raiden's part, it's even though he's struggling with his faith and his role in the faith, what finally, you know, pushes him over the edge is the external influence of Diloph. Stripping away the respect and power granted to him by his congregation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that really stuck with me, like the one of the quotes, was, I know it's technically like just the beginning of foreshadowing for the whole like king is doing the like sacrifice with the like mysteries and how like her maids keep disappearing, which I still feel like was a bit of a weird plot line but okay. I was rereading this and I was like, this is like weirder than I remember it being. but Serena comes in to find her room has, like, not been cleaned, and she's like, oh, it's not that big a deal, and Ashe says, like, you need to pay attention to what the people below you think, because they're the ones that you represent. Like, you keep focusing on the nobility around you, and you're not paying attention to the people that work in the castle, you're not paying attention to, like, the citizens themselves. And so I thought that was that was interesting in her character arc, was, like, learning to, like, kind of broaden her view almost, and, like... Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
And on top of that, like, here's a good parallel, like a good foil to her character, is that Raoden does pay attention to the people below him, but he doesn't pay attention to the people on his level.
Exactly, because that's something that Ashe actually says, is she's like, wow, I'm not a good princess, am I? Like, Raoden was so much better at this. And Ashe says something along the lines of like, well, you guys paid attention to different things, that doesn't necessarily make you better, it just depends on what's important in that moment.
I think that's also like part of like what makes them work well as a couple, like despite like criticisms people have around Brandon's romances and whatnot. I do think that Serena and Raiden work really well, even though if they don't spend much time together and it's an arranged marriage and blah 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 blah. But they really do work well together, even when Serena doesn't know who like Raiden is. Like, there's this like natural chemistry, the way that like each of them like focuses on different things. And, like, they can bring those things together.
And I want the sequel so badly.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I know in the sequel that we're not going to have the same major point of view characters.
Yeah, it's like Cheyenne's children, right?
Yep. K-I-C, Casey, however you want to pronounce it.
I forgot. But those, they are, I think, is her brother. And, well, Aiden, I imagine.
Yeah.
Maybe Luko? Who knows?
Yeah, I've got no clue. But yeah, I really liked their like relationship and stuff. Again, this was like one of my first real adult fantasy books besides like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So I pretty much only knew of like Game of Thrones, and I was like, ooh, I don't want to get into that with all of that stuff. So I'll do Brandon Sanderson, which seems to have less like murder and rape. And so like reading this, I was like, oh, this is like a really wholesome romance. They work well together. They've got this kind of like mutual respect from the beginning. And like, I can work with this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like as good as I think some of the romances later on that he had more time to work on.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think they work well in like the short time that he has in this book.
Yeah, I mean, one of his best romances, in my opinion, Sirius of Sebron. I've been working on the relationship section of Sirius Page on the Coppermine because apparently it didn't have some Sebron on it. So I was doing that and just like reading the summaries because I won't reread Warbreaker until we do our episode, maybe. They're just so adorable. Some of Brandon's romances aren't great, but it's not like some of the Wheel of Time ones that aren't really weird.
Oh my gosh. Don't even get me started on that. I'm not even done with the series yet, but I already have so many opinions on the relationships.
You're on Lord of Chaos, right?
Yes, just started it.
Ooh, nice.
wrap up so much.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. If you think I have a lot to say about the Cosmere, Wheel of Time was my first love.
Wheel of Time is amazing.
I did want to say that I think it's interesting that, from what I've got, Drew, your favorite character was Rathen,
mm-hmm.
and Shay's favorite character was Raiden, and my favorite character was Serene.
Oh, wow!
Well,
I didn't know that.
Which, like, because I really related to Rathen's arc, but I also felt way too, like, attacked by it, and so I did not really like him as a character. I was like, this is uncomfortable. I don't like reading this. And so with Serene, I could definitely relate as, like, I just started my freshman year in that engineering class, and I was, like, the only woman. I'm, like, in a STEM field, really uncomfortable. I had just moved states. And so I was relating to her in, like, an empowering way, whereas with Harathen, I'm like, I feel called out. I don't like this. And then Raiden just kind of, like, in the middle. I'm like, he's cool. I like him. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's nice that we've got, like, all three characters, like, represented.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
Yeah, like, I think part of what made me connect with Raiden so much, especially, like, was the fact that he's just so genuine and cares about people so much.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me a bit of, like, Adolin and how, oh my god, the both of them, they're just so, like, Adolin has his problems with bias and that because culture things, but I mean they're also just so caring about their friends and like the people that they're like in charge of, for lack of a better term, and like really want to empower the people. I can't say that. But there's a scene, chapter 12 of Rhythm of War, where Adolin does that for another character, and he helps them, and he, like, they really, like, all three of them, actually, Raiden and Serene and Rhythm, really understand what makes people tick in different ways.
Yes.
Serene and Rhythm are very, like, on the political side, Rhythm also manipulate them, like, with their feelings and with discourse, and like speeches, while like Serene does it in this like really subtle, like political way.
Oh, some of my favorite scenes in the book are when Serene and Rathen are like sparring.
Yes,
so good.
And like this is part of why like people say that Serene is like a proto Shallan, which I don't agree as much.
I see
her so much more as closer to her namesake from the Wheel of Time, who is instead of the White Aja. And who, like, really, like, understands people. And you'll get to that a bit later in the Wheel of Time, because I don't think you've met her yet.
No, not in Lord of Chaos, no.
But, like, they really, like, have this, like, deep understanding of people. And, like, that's part of what makes that particular plot line with the Aes Sedai work so well, despite how people complain about the million Aes Sedai. I really, really like it because they all understand people just like Serene and Raiden and Rathen do here.
So you brought up just kind of in passing, you mentioned kind of the political setting of this book. And I wanted to ask you guys if you noticed or had any thoughts on the way Brandon kind of portrays a socialism versus capitalism.
Yes!
Thing.
Oh my god, yes.
Oh my god.
Yes.
absolutely.
Yeah, and also history class the other day, like we were talking about like social Darwinism and all that in the Industrial Revolution in the United States, and there was one particular comment made that I was like, this is literally what's happening in Elantris, and I find it so interesting how Ren like combines and like alters a bit of things that happen in real life. Like the Merchant Revolution happened, but rather than going to the system of like, well, with the Industrial Revolution and like the Burguesia and all that, it goes back to a feudal system, which I found really interesting, like reading this, and also like the way the nobles like treat the people around them. And Serene's comment of like, treat the people well, they'll be more productive that way. This huge like dichotomy between the two systems, I found really, really interesting how like Brandon put those in, and you don't realize so much at first because it's like it's this fantasy setting. It reminds me a lot of that quote from Stover of like that interview. I put that quote in my extended essay because it's just perfect. At its best, fantasy reveals truths that cannot be shown any other way. That's exactly what's happening here, and you don't realize it until you like take like this deeper look.
Yeah
absolutely. I think I said earlier that I was reading this in like 2019. I think it's more accurately like 2017, early 2017. And so again, if this gets too political, I'll cut it, but I was reading this like right after Trump got elected and everything.
Oh.
And so like small, like, leftist Ilana was just, like, so angry at the system. And so whenever I was reading this, I was like, yeah, she's right. Like, we gotta fix this. We gotta, like, rally and treat the workers better. And was very, again, this is another thing that I find interesting with, like, comparing it to Mistborn, since it's what we just read, where you do have the similar dichotomy of, like, the main character being, like, we need to fix the system. We need to take it to a different, in Mistborn, it was, like, a more democratic system that Elend was going for. But here, she's definitely going for, like, a bit more of, like, a socialist system of everyone gets what they need, and, like, all the time, and, like, you don't have to work for food and stuff. This is kind of, like, very idyllic, very idealistic. Kind of utopian.
Yes, it is.
Not realistic at all. Which, again, I find interesting with, like, baby socialist Ilana being like, this is the way things should be. And now I'm like, okay, that's unrealistic. We gotta work. There's other work to be done first.
Yeah, but also kind of easier with, like, Elyntrian magic.
Oh, yeah. It's because, so like, much easier whenever there's magic involved.
Before everything.
But, yeah. And so then you have also the discussions of the pitfalls of, like, democracy and stuff like that in Mistborn. So it's interesting to see how there's governing systems being discussed throughout the different series that I thought was really interesting. And it's been an issue where I'm like, Stormlight almost makes me believe in, like, a monarchy system again. And then I have to, like, remind myself that that's terrible. Because I'm like, yeah, Dalinar's great. And then I'm like, wait, no.
So, like, he is a tyrant.
Let's review. Like, let's check things out again. Let's look back.
It's like, it's great when the guy in charge happens to be, like, this upright, morally strong, like, understanding, willing to change. But
like, who the heck knows what his kid's gonna be like?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that dude's gonna die eventually, but I mean, it's just, there have been so many times. It's
like, and he's great, but...
Yeah, I know it is great. But, and Renard is too.
But there's been so many times where I'm like, you know, this could really work. And I'm like, no, it couldn't. Gotta step back.
Yeah.
Gotta, like, remind myself that this is a fantasy book. Mm-hmm. There's magic. So, yeah, I thought I do think it's interesting to have the discussion of, like, capitalism versus socialism in this society, especially since they have such an extreme version of capitalism, I'd say.
Oh my god, it's insane.
So that was where my thoughts, like, kind of came down on this. And I think it's just an example of Brandon being an early career writer at this point. It's very heavy-handed. It's the socialism versus capitalism kind of theme in this book is just super in your face. It's very reductive and basically comes across as, like, only engaging with the worst parts of capitalism and the best parts of socialism.
Oh, absolutely, like, yeah. It is not at all, like, a well-developed discussion. It's just kind of like a, capitalism bad, socialism good sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you don't get, like, much of a nuanced discussion.
Which is something you get a lot more in things like Stormlight and Mistborn Era 2.
Interesting. I'm looking forward to that. I just started listening to the first book of Mistborn Era 1. Not Era 1, Era 2. Like Alloy of Law, I think. I'm like one chapter into it. So very excited to see how that goes.
Nice. I like Era 2 quite a lot.
Era 2.
Oh, nice.
Oh, I'm so excited.
I've heard people
for
have
Lost
mixed
Metal.
Feelings, so I was a little scared. But
yeah, I think
it seems good.
I think it largely comes down to the, like, the technology shift, where people really like the medieval aesthetic and struggle to adapt to a turn-of-the-century post-industrial setting.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm very intrigued by that setting, so, like, I don't have any issue with that.
Yeah, because the characters are very strong, the plots are tight.
Nice, because that was one issue that I had a bit with Mistborn, was it was, like, less character-focused and more, like, plot-based.
Era 2 is and very character-focused.
Great. I'm like, I'm very much a character reader, so I love to hear that.
Yeah, I am so excited for Lost Metal.
You should.
And I know you've read it, and it's a year away for us, and it's, like, so frustrating. But yeah, I deserve to be on the other side for once with things like Black Company and
Lost
Metal.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
Cal commented on that. I was so frustrated.
Raffo dictator of our Discord.
I was so frustrated with the cliffhanger at the end of Shadow Games and the Black Company. Yeah. And I was like, okay, fine. I deserve to be on the other side for once. And, like, I tagged Cal. I was like, see?
And I think I told you it's like, not even close to the worst cliffhanger in Black Company.
Don't worry.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, yeah, Cal commented on that. I was like, finally. I'm like, yeah, I know. I've always held Raffo's here. I mean, since Ilan and Alpha reading.
Oh my gosh.
Wheel of Time for the
it's
first time.
Constant.
Cal's reading Cosmere for the first time. So, I mean, yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, I was reading Era One and Wheel of Time at the same time. And so I'd have like different conversations going, and it's just constantly Raffoed. And I'm like, are you kidding me? <That's> Is there nothing else that you can say?
That's really funny.
I love you, Shay, but you deserve it.
I know I do.
I can't remember who mentioned it. I think we were discussing this maybe in the Discord or something, but it was saying that of all the like characters in the Cosmere, that like Raiden's the one that deserves to rule the most.
And Brandon said that before. I don't remember what interview it is.
He's the one that deserves to rule the most?
He's the one that deserves to be the king the most. I mean, because Dalinar, I mean, sure, like we talked about this, but Dalinar is a tyrant and wait.
Yeah, so I was just curious what your thoughts on that were, since we are discussing kind of like the political system there.
I mean, just as a reflex response, I'd say that's pretty fair. He has the right attitude for it. Like, generally speaking, the best leaders are the ones who don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's from the Elantris annotations.
Oh, okay.
Which you were talking about earlier. Like, if I were to assign Raiden two defining traits, the first would be his ability to make the best of what he's given, as I've spoken of above. The second, however, would be the personality trait he manifests in this chapter, his simple belief in the goodness of the human race. I suppose this is a facet of his optimism. Raiden believes in people. He believes that, as a whole, they will do what is right. He believes that they are more rational than the nobility sometimes gives them credit. He believes that most men will do what is good if they are presented with all the facts. He really is a noble man. He's perhaps the only person I've written in a fantasy book who, from day one, actually deserved to be king.
I like that. I mean, there are characters in Mistborn that jump to mind that I'm like, great leader, definitely should not be king.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, my gosh.
And, like, I think that's really interesting, like, in a comparison that I've heard some people make of Raiden with Eland, and, or Eland, however you pronounce it, I switch all the time. And, like, they both have, like, the same, like, optimism. But Eland is a lot more naive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have that ability Raiden has to, like, do the best with what he's been given. Mm-hmm. And we see that in Well of Ascension. And that comparison is really interesting. Especially because this story is about, like, the characters dealing with what they've been thrown into. And Raiden just manages to get that. Then he puts on this, like, mask of confidence. Like, okay, I'm the leader. And he gets things done. Mm-hmm. Not really. Sorry. As much as I love him, not really.
Yeah. I think Eland has a lot more of, like, an intellectual idea of, like, what it means to rule, whereas Raiden has a more, like, practical experience with it. And so while he is willing to do, like, the scholarship to figure out what's going on with the Aeons and stuff like that and be like, maybe there's something we need to fix here, he's also, like, actively working with the people around him to change things, whereas Eland in the past has just kind of locked himself in a room with books and been like, this is how you rule a kingdom, and hasn't really been out, like, with the people doing things.
Sorry, I just had a thought that I can't talk about, and it's killing me.
Ah, so frustrating. Sorry. That happens.
It's okay.
I imagine it's lost metal.
It is.
Oh my gosh. So God, jealous. So and weird. I haven't even read Era 2.
It's a year away. Normally it's a shorter time gap.
Yeah, yeah.
This time it's a year.
This is going to be by far the longest gap between beta and release since I've started beta reading.
Oof, that's rough.
But I also think it's going to make the book great in the end, because it's going to be able to go through a lot of revisions. And also, well, he does have to write Skyward 4, but...
Yes, he does.
It's going to help a lot with revisions. The common people say, and like he's talked about himself, like, if, like, I had more time, like, I could make these better, but I also want to, like, stay on schedule because a lot of reasons. And so it's, like, this balance that I think that will really help the Lost Metal, especially since it's the end of Eret.
Yeah, I was just chatting with a couple of people the other day on the Legendarium Discord server about how I really hope at some point Brandon comes out and talks more in depth about the beta process for Risen 4.
Yeah, I remember that.
Because there was a really interesting process there, given the circumstances of, you know, the beta read happened right when COVID hit. And
with that book in particular.
Yeah, yeah. And And he's talked a little bit about some of the responses he got in the beta and some of the changes he made and some of the changes he didn't make based on the feedback, where he's like, is there really a problem with this book here? Or is it just people are getting hammered with isolation right now and are responding more strongly to this book than mm-hmm. they normally would because of these unique circumstances? And between the really fast timeline where, you know, the beta read started, what, eight and a half months before the book came out, and the pandemic hitting, it was like,
oh gosh,
it was a unique set of circumstances for sure. So I'm excited that he gets to take a more leisurely pace now. He has more time to take a breather, build up kind of his backlog again, where he's not constantly rushing. And hopefully by the time we get to Elantris 2, you know, he's maybe got like a buffer of a book or two where,
oh yeah, mm-hmm. and that's for Worlds do what they did with Shadows and Bands and Secret History.
Oh, I mean, that'd be fun, but
I mean, fun for us, but not fun for Brandon.
I think that's also another point we didn't bring up when we were talking about the 10th anniversary edition, is that that also included an Ars Arcanum for this book.
Oh,
this
book's yes, true.
Oh.
And the Ars Arcanum is pretty interesting.
I haven't seen that one. I don't have the 10th anniversary edition. Well, my ebook that isn't the 10th anniversary edition.
Your ebook isn't?
No.
Oh, that should automatically update.
Huh. That's weird.
Yeah. I bought the regular ebook, and after the 10th anniversary came out, it automatically updated to the extra content. But yeah, adding that, I think, was a really smart idea, because the magic in here is, even with the revelations at the end of the book, it's still pretty confusing, like how things work on this planet, because this planet is weird. And I don't want to get too into that, because that's definitely Cosmere spoiler discussion, but I thought it was worth bringing up that he added the Ars Arcanum in the 10th anniversary.
Now I want to read that.
Yeah, I was about to say I'll loan you my copy and then realize that, like, we are still in two different countries. but yeah, I'll be honest in that I did not read the Ars Arcanum the first time, because, again, this is my first Cosmere book, and I was like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
There's, like, more reading without characters? Why? but I will go back and read that tonight, because I think that will help answer a lot of the questions that I have.
Yeah, the Ars Arcana started off as pretty straightforward, just like glossary, this is how the magic works. But as he got further into the books, he started bringing in more commentary, like in character commentary, because there's a specific person who writes them. But this 10th anniversary edition of it was one of the first that really brought in like new information about the Cosmere, where he mentions a planet in this that it was the first time this planet had ever been mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I will definitely have to go back and reread that then.
So.
Yeah, the magic systems are fascinating. I really want to learn more about them.
This might end up being one of our shortest episodes.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Oh my God, our short light ones are eternal.
Oh my God. I'm so glad we have this pre-recorded, because they're like 3.5 hours long.
Oh wow.
Like
for each
I'm not
part.
Looking forward
like,
to editing
even
them.
The whole book. It's like each part. They're long.
Oh my God. Yep. So yeah, this will be nice and quick to edit. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I think that's it. So you can follow us and contact us in all our social media. The links, like always, are in the show notes. Join the Discord. We have a lot of fun conversations there. Not only about the Cosmere, like we have a Wheel of Time channel. It's fun seeing your theories and your reactions. Tell us your feedback. Ask us your questions. We always love listener questions. I forgot to put up the call today. Sorry for questions. But we always love to hear thoughts and listener questions tend to be really, really interesting. And if you enjoy the show, please like support us on Ko-fi or rate us on iTunes. It really helps. We really want to improve the quality and like audio and things. And yeah, tell us your theories regarding what's going on in Brandon's head about the Cosmere, because there's a lot to discuss. So much, honestly, especially now that we're closing. Well, it's gonna take a long time because we do these monthly, but when we get to Era 2, it's gonna be really, really interesting to see what people's theories for Lost Metal are, because honestly, I'm not very sure where it's going. I am really interested, but I just don't have any predictions as for what will happen. I know you, Reddit. Oh my god.
My lips resist.
Yeah, it's like, I know you've read it. Yeah, and also, well, share the podcast with other Brandon Sanderson fans, you know. My god, Alpha's stuck the Brandon's thing to me, and it's so annoying. And, well, anyone you want to introduce to the series, we know how overwhelming it can be. Try to explain this to someone new. Because we've gone through it. It's hard.
Yeah.
You can follow Drew on Inking Out Loud. It's an amazing podcast. Like with my birthday coming up, one of my friends, I was like, okay, which books are highest on your TBR? Like, almost all of them, like 90% were things that you've covered on Inking Out Loud that I really want to read.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you.
I mean, I've been loving Black Company, which was your recommendation. I'm really excited to continue on with that.
Yes, I've been greatly enjoying your chapter by chapter commentary on Discord.
Anyway, thanks for listening, and remember, journey before destination.
Bye.